we estimate it to be around 25 meters thick. So that's pretty substantial.
Encroaching sea ice halts Shell's Chukchi drilling a day after it begins. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, September 10th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, New Talk villagers connect with global warming refugees around the world.
The rain is coming in, right? It's pushing the land, you know, lower and lower. We're like minus 30 feet from the sea level right now.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
A recent statewide survey by Dittman Research show that 65% of Alaskans think it's time to build the Kinnick Arm Crossing, and 77% of those surveyed believe the bridge will save Alaskans time, money, and provide our economy with needed jobs. For facts on the Kinnick Arm Bridge, visit kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority.
After months of delays and mishaps, Shell Oil began drilling in the Arctic yesterday. But as KUCB's Stephanie Joyce reports, the operation isn't off to a smooth start.
When the Noble Discoverer drill rig cut into the Chukchi seafloor Sunday morning, it was the first time in more than two decades that an oil company had drilled in the U.S. Arctic. Shell was triumphant, spokesperson Curtis Smith.
It's an exciting day for Shell, for Alaska, hopefully the beginning of another important chapter in Alaska's oil and gas history.
The triumph was short-lived, though. Just a few hours later, the Noble Discoverer had to disconnect from the well site and get out of the way of a massive island of sea ice bearing down on the area.
It's about 30 miles long. It's about 12 miles wide. And it's moving about 0.3 to 0.5 knots. It varies in thickness, of course, but in its thickest area, we estimate it to be around 25 meters thick. So that's pretty substantial.
Smith says operations could be shut down for several days while the island moves past the drill site.
When we worked on the Chukchi Sea and the Beaufort in the 1980s and 1990s, this happened then, so it's not unusual. I think the key there, of course, is just having a heads-up approach and making sure that you see what's coming.
This incident is just the latest in a series of snafus for the oil giant. Sea ice postponed the start of the drilling season, then the Noble Discoverer ran adrift during a storm in Unalaska, and most recently, permitting problems have kept Shell's oil spill containment barge tied up at the dock in Washington State. Shell received permission to start drilling without the barge on site, but the company is limited to drilling into rock layers above the oil reserves they're trying to prove exist. Even if the barge receives its final permits this week, it won't make it to the Arctic before the end of the Chukchi drilling season. Shell has asked the Interior Department to extend the season beyond September 24th, but Interior Secretary Ken Salazar has said previously that he won't even consider it until the barge is finished. That could mean it will be another year before Shell can obtain definitive proof that there's an oil bonanza hiding below the Arctic seafloor. But Shell's Curtis Smith says the company isn't discouraged by all the problems.
The way we're looking at it is drilling is drilling, and the only question remaining for this season is how much we drill before we run out of time.
Shell had originally planned to drill 5 exploratory wells this summer. At this point, 1 or 2 is more likely. The company still hasn't received permits to start drilling in the Beaufort Sea, where its other drill rig, the Kulik, is waiting out the end of the fall subsistence whale hunt. In Unalaska, I'm Stephanie Joyce.
Two representatives from the village of Newtok and an immigration specialist are traveling to the Carteret Islands in Papua New Guinea this week to meet with islanders there and share information about how to take charge of plans for relocating communities vulnerable to coastal erosion. Stanley Tom is a tribal administrator for the Traditional Council in Newtok, a Yupik community of around 400, about 90 miles west of Bethel. In an interview before leaving Alaska, Tom said Newtok is moving forward with their own plans for relocating and training community members for jobs, building an emergency evacuation center this month.
So we are excited to build our own community. And I did send in like about 17 students to certify them at the Kotzebue. So I have like carpenters, laborers, electricians, you know, they all certified. And we're just excited to build our new community.
Tom says they've built 3 houses in the new village site and are working on 3 more. He says he's hoping to learn from the Carteret Islanders and work with them to help other vulnerable communities. The Carteret Islanders are relocating because of rising sea levels. They've been called the world's first environmental refugees. Tom says for Newtok, erosion and flooding risks are increasing at a rapid pace, and the village has sunk below sea level.
The rain is coming in, right? It's pushing the land, you know, lower and lower. We're like minus 30 feet from the sea level right now. So we are really flood-prone area. The erosion is coming in. We're losing already 30 to 50 feet already. And it's coming in. I mean, our water source is nearly about 154 feet right now as we speak. And once that water source is impacted, where will we get our water?
Stanley's cousin, George Tom, is also part of the delegation to the South Pacific. George is 64 and has lived in the Nutak area all his life. But he says the original village was farther inland and was only moved closer to the coast because of the federal government.
Because they were planning to build a BIA school that time when I was growing up in the old village sites, but the barges couldn't come in, go inland.
So the village was moved to where supplies could be more easily delivered. Robin Bronin helped spearhead the effort in bringing the Alaska and New Guinea communities together. Bronin is the executive director of the Alaska Immigration Justice Project. She says she's been observing the relocation process in Nutak since 2007 and started researching other efforts internationally. She found the Carteret Islanders, who are moving to a bigger island. She says relocations in the past were always forced moves perpetrated by governments, but the two communities meeting in the South Pacific right now are changing that.
And what the Nutak Traditional Council and Tulele Pesa are doing is creating a different model that I believe needs to be implemented. We need to figure out how this form of relocation can be the precedent-setting model where you have communities actually making all of the decisions regarding whether they relocate, where they relocate, and how they relocate.
Bronin says funding is always an issue. She says following a disaster, money for rebuilding is often available, but accessing those funds usually requires rebuilding in the same place instead of in a stable area that won't be ravaged by coastal storms and erosion. George Tom says when his village can move to a new location, they will no longer have to worry about salt water compromising their fresh water supply.
The new village site is promising because it's higher ground. It's more fresh water, mountain water. Water's so close you can drink, just go outside and dip your cup and drink.
Bronin says the next phase of the project is for the people of the Carteret Islands to come to Alaska next spring or fall, and then a combined delegation will travel to Washington, D.C. to work with other affected communities through the Center for International Environmental Law and the UN Environment Program. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, hundreds of veterans in Southeast find access to housing and healthcare services.
I kept hearing they're not getting the benefits they should be getting. And that's why this is happening today.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein. Attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
Alaska Housing Finance Corporation offers home choice seminars that provide tools for making informed decisions about purchasing and financing a home, and loans tailored for first-time home buyers. There's more information at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by Alaska Housing Finance Corporation.
Anchorage is about to have a simulated terrorist attack, and the Army, the Fire Department, and hundreds of specialists will be in the city to deal with it. It's the annual national training exercise of the Alliance of Hazardous Materials Professionals, who are having their convention in Anchorage. APRN's Steve Heimel dropped in.
There's about 500 of them here, meeting at the Hilton to talk about new equipment, techniques, and regulatory changes, but mostly to compare notes and stay sharp. One of their trainers is a former Alaska State Trooper named Steve Williams, now a consultant down in Oregon. He says for the last 10 years they've conducted a major hazardous materials response drill in whatever community they meet in. So down the hill at the railroad station, there's going to be a lot of action Wednesday as they simulate a terrorist toxic gas attack.
Terrorists have decided to intentionally release a chemical agent on the train, and we are going to use all available resources to do that drill. We will have law enforcement, fire, emergency medical and hazmat from the Anchorage area. We'll also have the Army's civil support team, so this will be as real as it gets.
It has gotten pretty real here in Alaska in the past. In spring of 1986, an Alaska Railroad crew noticed a tank car leaking and they hauled it to a siding at Crown Point on the Kenai Peninsula. Nobody knew what the chemical was. The leak produced a fog that filled the valley from Crown Point to Moose Pass. There was no evacuation plan. It was a textbook example of how not to respond to a chemical spill. It would not happen that way today because the law was changed the next year. Not so much because of the Crown Point spill, but because of a horrific release at a Union Carbide chemical plant in Bhopal, India that killed at least 23,000 people, and then a very similar Union Carbide accident in Institute, West Virginia, where the wind ended up blowing the cloud away from the town instead of towards it.
It could have killed thousands of people. And that's when Congress came up with the Community Right to Know law, which required planning, training, and sharing of emergency capabilities between communities. It's now law. It came in the late 80s. It came in after the Crown Point incident.
Those toxic spills were really in the early years of chemical regulation. Federal laws dealing with toxic chemicals were established with the rise of environmental consciousness back in the early 1970s. Steve Williams says he got into the field himself back then because he realized how unprepared he was as a law enforcement officer to deal with a fatal ammonia release at an Anchorage fish processing plant. He also remembers being on the state trooper security detail and meeting President Richard Nixon as he passed through Alaska on his first trip to China.
I actually started in 1970. That's when President Nixon signed into law things like OSHA, EPA. You realize before that, it was just an industry practice thing. There was no legal requirements. So we're really only 40 years in to the technology and the regulations being mandatory.
The drill at the Alaska Railroad Depot will involve full response equipment, and the public and news media are encouraged to come and watch. Emergency preparedness has been on the minds of many in Anchorage after last week's windstorm and power outages. Williams encourages people to go to websites run by the Department of Homeland Security and the American Red Cross to find out more. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
The power companies in Anchorage say only a small number of customers are still without electricity in the wake of the severe windstorm that hit the city last week. Anchorage Mayor Dan Sullivan has made no public comment since the big storm. But city spokesperson Lindsay Witt says the City Office of Emergency Management has issued a damage survey through the city website. The survey will help the city decide if a declaration of emergency is warranted. City Office of Emergency Management can also be contacted through its Facebook page. According to Witt, city police were swamped with calls during the storm.
Dispatch saw a record number of phone calls go in on the night of the storm. However, we're very fortunate for a few things. One being that this is in September and it's not winter months. And although many Alaskans realize how cold it is without having a furnace, we are very fortunate that it wasn't in the middle of winter.
Witt says no deaths or serious injuries have been reported as a result of the storm, nor has the city received word of any major loss of property. The Red Cross's Katie Bender says her organization has helped only two families find temporary shelter since the storm hit last Tuesday. Meanwhile, the cleanup continues. The Anchorage Botanical Garden was hit particularly hard. The garden's director, Julianne McGinnis, says 50 or more trees are down at the 80-acre garden at the foot of the Chugach Mountains.
And you can see where they are already cleaned up some of these sections of fence. The trees just retied up. So the first order of business Wednesday was getting the fence secured so moose don't get into the garden. So we went around from both angles and just started pulling trees off the fence.
The garden leases the land from the municipality. It closed for 2 days so workers could assess safety concerns. So far, volunteers have cleared most of the garden's trails, and the facility has reopened for its usual hours.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Providence Imaging Center, helping cancer patients stay in Anchorage with a PET scanner that fuses anatomical and functional images since 2004. Learn more at provimaging.com.
The Project Management Institute will present 3 one-day seminars at the Petroleum Club of Anchorage, October 9th, 10th, and 11th. Expert Neil Whitten will present No-Nonsense Advice for Successful Projects, Let's Talk, More No-Nonsense Advice for Project Success, and The Gift of Wisdom, Work-Life Balance for Today's Managers, Learn to Manage Projects, and more. Registration information at pmiak.org. This message sponsored by Project Management Institute, Alaska Chapter.
A new research ship to be based in Alaska hits the water next month. The 261-foot Sikuliak is being built at a shipyard in Marinette, Wisconsin, for the National Science Foundation. The $200 million ice-going ship will be operated by the University of Alaska Fairbanks and home-ported at its Seward Marine Center to serve scientists from around the world. UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences Dean Michael Castellini says work is progressing on the Sikuliak in preparation for launching October 13th.
We've got 38 days to launch, and it's been painted at this point. And in about 10 days, they're going to take it out of the building that it's been constructed in, and they put the last bits on top, the superstructure, the tower, because the building is just not tall enough to do that. And then they'll roll it out next to the river, and we launch it into the river. At that point, it's about 80% complete. And they'll spend the next couple of months putting stuff on.
In 2013, the Sikuliak will sail through Lake Michigan, out the St. Lawrence Seaway, down the east coast of the U.S., through the Panama Canal, and then up to Alaska. It's scheduled to arrive in Seward in January of 2014. The vessel will be able to travel through up to 2.5 feet of ice, a capability Castellini says will make it unique in the United States.
There is no other ice-capable research vessel in the entire U.S. fleet. So this is it. It's the only game in town. So that's why we're very excited about it. And it's global class. I mean, that means it's the most robust, strongest, capable of going anywhere in the world's oceans. And there's only 3 or 4 of those at all in the United States anyway. And this is the only ice-capable one.
Castellini says the NSF will pay UAF about $14 million a year to operate the vessel, with a resulting direct cash injection into Alaska of $3.5 to $5 million annually. A group of 10 UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences staff have relocated to Wisconsin to work on the Sikuliak project. The ship's crew of 40 will join them next year. Once in operation, the Sikuliak will accommodate up to 26 scientists on a range of projects, employing technology, including remotely operated vehicles and sonar to explore the sea. There are new developments in the battle over a popular fishing area near Sitka. The board of a closed college and a native corporation have filed competing ownership claims. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Sitka's Sheldon Jackson College shuttered its doors about 5 years ago, but its board of trustees continues to operate, managing old debts and property that hasn't yet been sold or given away. That includes Readout Falls, about a 15-minute skiff ride south of the Baranoff Island community. The falls and parts of a same-named lake and bay make up the trustees' 160-acre claim. Readout is a much-used sport and subsistence fishing area.
Our goal is to continue to make available to the general public the access to the subsistence sockeye fishing that is so important to the community.
That's Trustees Board Vice Chairwoman Heather McCarty speaking at a recent press conference. She says the board still has a few $100,000 of debt to pay, but
we will not be using ownership of Readout to develop or change in any way the current use of the property.
Sheldon Jackson trustees filed a claim earlier this year with the Federal Bureau of Land Management, which decides ownership. The trustees do not have the actual title or deed documenting Readout sale from before the United States bought Alaska from Russia, but they recently filed detailed legal paperwork tracing ownership through 1981, when the property was deeded to the college. That claim is countered by Sea Alaska. The Southeast Regional Native Corporation filed for title to an approximately 10-acre site around Readout Falls in the mid-1970s. It's the last part of about 95 cultural and historic sites the corporation requested as part of its Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act land selections. Sea Alaska Executive Vice President Rick Harris says the trustees' claims are for long-gone buildings, not land.
Plus, it ignores the historic Tlingit use before Russian occupancy, during Russian occupancy, and then even after Russian occupancy.
Harris says Sea Alaska can prove Readout is a Native cultural and historic site eligible for selection under the Settlement Act. He says the Bureau of Land Management was close to conveying the land when Sheldon Jackson filed its competing claim. College trustees attorney Cabot Christensen says the board decided to speed legal action after Sea Alaska's claim started getting more attention.
We became concerned that the fisheries protection was not going to be sufficient to protect the fisheries program that was ongoing, that's been ongoing there for the last 30 years. And we also became concerned that the public access rights were not being protected.
Sheldon Jackson says it's seeking a partner to share management of the Readout area and eventually take it over. Sea Alaska says it would do a better job working with local officials to maintain access. Harris says the corporation has been negotiating a management and use agreement with Sitka's municipal and tribal governments. He says talks also included the Forest Service, which takes measures to boost sockeye production in the lake.
The Sitka tribe was very clear in its expectation that this site would be one that all of the community would be able to use for subsistence purposes, and that the fisheries enhancement projects that are currently on the site are ongoing.
Critics have worried Sea Alaska might lose Readout, as well as other lands, if it failed and went bankrupt. Harris says the corporation is financially secure, and fishermen should worry more about a possible Sheldon Jackson takeover.
They're an organization that is, I will say, a defunct institution, and it has creditors. We don't understand what their relationship is, and if Sheldon Jackson actually receives title, I'm not certain how they can guarantee that the property will not be transferred to another entity.
It's unclear how long federal officials will take to sort through the claims. In the meantime, it will continue to be managed by the U.S. Forest Service. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting from Sitka.
Sea Alaska has now formally responded to the trustees' new claim documents. The corporation says it can prove the site was a traditional Tlingit fishing village owned by Sitka's Kiksati clan. Sea Alaska also says the Russians paid rent to use the area, and Russian law prohibited colonists from appropriating Tlingit-owned property. More than 800 military vets attended the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs' first ever stand-down in Southeast Alaska last week. Stand-down events are designed to give veterans access to health care and housing services, both from the VA and local nonprofits. As KTOO's Casey Kelly reports, a new agreement between the VA and Alaska Native health care providers should make it easier for vets in rural Alaska to access those services.
Alaska VA spokeswoman Marcia Hoffman-DeVoe says the agreement signed in May allows Native health care providers to directly bill the VA for care provided to veterans.
Even though we have probably the largest geographic area of any state, our veterans in Alaska will probably have the best access to either directly provided VA health care or care that we purchase from a community or Alaska Native provider.
Lincoln Bean Sr. of CAKE is a board member for the Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium and Alaska Native Health Systems. He's not a veteran himself, but he helped negotiate the agreement because when he was growing up, those who served were among the most respected members of his community.
World War I, World War II, Korea, Vietnam, Afghanistan. And I kept hearing they're not getting the benefits they should be getting. And that's why this is happening today.
While Anchorage and Fairbanks have hosted stand-downs for years, the event at Centennial Hall Friday and Saturday was the first one held in Southeast Alaska. It's part of the VA's effort to expand its presence in the state. The Southeast Native Veterans Group opened the event with the presentation of colors.
Order.
Tony Mills is an Army vet from Hoonah who served during Vietnam. He says he's had issues with the VA in the past, During a visit to a VA clinic in Anchorage in 1998, Mills says the doctor didn't even know what branch of the service he'd been in.
He said, "How long were you in the Marine Corps?" I told him, "Marine Corps, I never was in the Marine Corps." I told him I got drafted in the Army.
Mills says he's glad to hear about the new sharing agreement, which he plans to take advantage of at the search clinic in Hoonah. He also says the two-year-old VA clinic in Juneau's federal building should make it easier to access the medical tests he needs.
I'll be coming back this coming Wednesday for the hearing test that we're, I guess they're going to have it up on the 6th floor. And the Coast Guard doctor from Mount Edgecombe, and he come over. And this is the one that got me going on this.
This bag's going to be some full.
Stand-down events date back to Vietnam, when frontline soldiers would rotate to a safe and secure area for hot meals, medical treatment, and new uniforms. Traditionally, non-combat stand-downs focus on homeless vets and vets in need. The VA brought two semi-truck loads of military surplus gear to Juneau for the Southeast stand-down. Socks, underwear, jackets, backpacks, and other supplies filled one of the ballrooms at Centennial Hall, available to any vet who needed something. Ex-Marine Dan Roberts came looking for a new sleeping bag.
I sleep on my boat, and it gets kind of chilly now because I don't use my heater at night.
We have you a sleeping bag liner, the shell.
As he collected his new sleeping bag from a volunteer, Roberts talked about how much it and all the other supplies mean to him.
Shoes, bag, sleeping bag, deluxe, and other clothing, socks and underwear, and you name it, lunch. I'm overwhelmed.
For those veterans who couldn't make it to the stand down in Juneau, the VA arranged for gear to be shipped to smaller communities throughout Southeast. The VA's Marsha Hoffman DeVoe says the agency would like to see a local nonprofit organize it into an annual event. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Stephanie Joyce in Unalaska, Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Ed Schoenfeld and Casey Kelly in Juneau. APRN's Steve Heimel also reported from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
And by
First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. Young drivers, texting and cell phone use while driving create distractions. Don't let your next text cause a wreck. If your middle or high school is interested in having a youth representative speak to your students about workplace safety, call Alaska Occupational Safety and Health Youth Safety at 1-800-656-4972. This message is sponsored by Alaska Labor Standards and Safety.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.